was empty except for two chairs. One was high-backed and red plush, elevated on a sandalwood plinth. The other was a plain but comfortable-looking white seat. It didn't take a genius to deduce which one was his. 5 minutes later, the back door opened. He stood quickly. For the first time, Blaze met the man he'd been fighting for the last 10 years. He had seen Modigan from a distance on a few occasions, however, so he wasn't surprised by the king's limp, or the fact he refused the use of a cane. Like most nobles, he was tall, and though he was on the wrong side of 60, he'd succumbed to neither paunchiness nor the rickety thinness that greeted so many men on their approach to old age. He had the broad, flat nose common to Gascon aristocracy, and his stare was like the glare of sunlight from polished silver. The door closed behind him. He moved to his throne and stood before it, facing Blaze.
"You are Pendulous."
Blaze knelt and bowed his head until it touched the king's outstretched hands. "My liege."
"You may sit," the king said.
Blaze obeyed. The king was silent for a moment.
"I have heard of you."
That had the ring of significance. Blaze cocked a brow.
"Should I be honored or worried I've done something that warrants spying?" "I would be yourself."
"In any event, your invitation is as humbling as it is mysterious." The king squinted.
"Are you a man of words?"
"I've been known to wield them."
"Most men of your trade are. Occupational hazard. It's your job to convince people to give you money.
Whereas kings are men of action, always rolling up their scepters and wading into the front lines."
Modigan chuckled, without smiling. "I said nothing about dividing the world between men of words and men of action."
Blaze tapped the arm of his chair. "You'd add a third type to the list?" The king nodded gravely.
"Men of decision."
"Not the man who cooks the breakfast, but the man who decides it's time for the fast to be broken."
"An apt summary, although constructed to hold as little rhetorical weight as possible. Rather, the distinction should be drawn at the level of a general and his soldiers. Does a general act? Does he dive into battle with drawn sword? Only if he is a fool, or if the battle is going very poorly. Instead, he decides."
"Sounds a lot like acting to me," Blaze said. Modigan made a small gesture with his fingertip.
"Only a man of words would argue that point."
With difficulty, Blaze stopped his eyes from rolling.
"You're the ultimate decider, aren't you? You didn't invite me here to play games with words, so the question is, have you made your decision already, or am I being judged right now?"
Modigan smiled with the detached amusement of those elevated beyond all mortal concerns.
"I will buy your bossen."
"You will?" The king nodded. Blaze shifted in his chair.
"You'll have to excuse me. I've never done business with a regent before. When you say you'll buy it, do you mean if I wish to sell it to you? Or do you mean that the same way you'd say, I will conquer Malin?"
Modigan tipped his head 5 degrees. The man's gestures were all small, forcing you to pay constant attention to his every mood.
"If it were an offer instead of an order, would you refuse me?"
"If it were an offer, I'd ask to hear your terms, then ride straight to your rivals and see if they wanted to up the bidding." But he knew these were words. The king had decided. Blaze's task was to play along.
"May I ask your proposal?" "The whole shipment. Same terms you've offered the others."
My instincts scream at me to haggle, but my brains tell me that if I attempt to take advantage of your lofty finances, I'll find my body dragged through the streets by a fancy horse.
"Something like that," Modigan said. "Do you have the goods here?"
"Close enough.
Then I shall send for you in 3 days to conclude affairs.
He leaned back. Blaise began to rise, but the king twitched his fingers, stilling him.
I have heard your concerns about the safety of the king's roads.
Blaise laughed with as much self-deprecation as he could muster.
In my defense, if we could saddle complaints, our feet would never have to touch the ground.
I will deal with the roads, Modigan said. You will speak of it no more.
Is that what this is about?
Blaise made a quick calculation, then pressed on.
This isn't the strongest of bribes.
I had another buyer.
This was about business. The roads are a secondary matter, but they are the veins of my empire. If circulation is blocked, the limbs wither.
Blaise bowed low enough to show the crown of his head.
I will say no more, my lord.
The servant opened the door and escorted Blaise to the lift, then the carriage outside. As Blaise returned home, he sensed the city but absorbed none of its impressions, like a sponge too saturated to take on any more water. As usual, Taya intercepted him in the foyer of the manor. Blaise had been working with his servants for months and trusted them to a man, yet he refused to speak until he and Taya were alone in the library, doors and windows shut from prying eyes and ears.
Forget about the Duke, he said. We're taking down the king.
This audiobook has been broken into multiple parts to make the download faster. You have reached the end of a part, but not the end of the complete audiobook. So please check your library for the next part of this audiobook.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.
This is Audible.
Podium Publishing presents The Cycle of Aron, The Complete Trilogy. Written by Edward W. Robertson. Read by Tim Gerard Reynolds. Chapter 7. They were 3 hours into the journey, and 20 miles west of the city, before Dante realized he was missing a vital piece of information. Where exactly are we headed? She gave no indication she'd heard. For a moment, he thought his words had been lost beneath the tromp of the horse's hooves and the coo of the birds in the trees. It was black as sin except for a small pool of light he was maintaining in front of C's mount to watch for any bad spots in the road that might cripple a horse.
To find your friend, she said at last. Useful information. While I have this here, can you tell me more about this ground we're walking on?
You'll find out where we're going once we're there.
That's just it, Dante said. I will see. So why not tell me now?
To encourage you to see the deal to the end.
You've already got my coin and my word. Do you realize I could rescind both with one flick of Netha?
If I were going to kill you, what difference does it make whether it's now or when we reach our destination?
C clopped along. Without turning, she said, Setevan.
Setevan? Dante said.
What's he doing there?
Last I saw, getting rich.
Is a widowed dowager involved? C turned, but her expression was silhouetted by the light at the front of the horses.
I wouldn't be surprised. He's doing business with every nobleman and woman in the court.
A misstep from the horse jostled Dante's spine, but his brain was reeling before that.
You must be mistaken. We fought a war against those people.
I followed him for weeks, except when I couldn't. Like when he went to stay at one of their chateaus.
There has to be more to it.
See for yourself, she said. Either way, I'm keeping the silver.
He couldn't believe it, yet her confidence undermined his own. What would motivate Blaise to trade with those who'd once been their worst enemies? Was he mistaken? Was Blaise up to something? Or had he simply moved on, putting his past with Setevan behind him as thoroughly as he'd done so with Narashtovic? If so, He wouldn't be the first to forsake everything else in pursuit of a life of wealth and pleasure. Maybe he thought he had nothing left to him. Dante lapsed into silence. They'd crossed a few villages after leaving Narashtovik, but they were currently traveling to a stretch of woods populated entirely by squirrels and owls. That night, they had to make camp in the wilds. Compared to sleeping in caves in the Wodans, however, the discomfort was trifling. They made steady progress, pushing the horses without exceeding their limits, stabling them in a new town each night. Dante wanted nothing more than to race all the way to Setevan, but his impatience was tempered by an ironclad fact. If C was right about plays, he wouldn't be going anywhere soon. Not if he was in bed with the capital. Not when there was a fortune to be had. It was an odd thing. Blaise had never been greedy. Even when Dante had been elevated to the council, and all the wealth of Narashtovik had been at their disposal, Blaise had shown little interest in throwing it around. He'd wanted no more than clean clothes, sharp swords, and the occasional night in the taverns. He'd mocked merchants more than once, scorning them for scurrying around after slivers of silver, noses buried too deep in their ledgers to ever see the world around them. But the death of Lyra had broken him. That much was clear. It was why Blaise had left. In that state, he could have become anything. Grief had a way of transforming a person into what they most hated. Perhaps instead of killing himself, falling in with the enemy was Blaze's way of destroying everything he'd once been, and his pain with it. Mile after mile faded behind them. Pine forests and grassy plains and ridges of weathered limestone. He gave some thought to sailing to Yalan and then heading upriver to the capital, but in all likelihood that would require backtracking to Narashtovik to find passage on a boat. Instead, they took the road nearly all the way to Dolandun before cutting overland to the west, intercepting the road and the river after a day in the wilds. The mountains of Galador sat in the south, gauzed in mist. A fork in the road fed them straight toward Setevan. They were deep in Gask now, and Dante rode with his cowl pulled over his head. He wasn't certain what would happen if he were recognized. Narashtovik had been at peace with its former masters for more than 3 years, and while the two states weren't throwing each other tea parties, neither were they on the brink of conflict. But peaceful relations between countries would mean nothing to anyone who bore Dante a personal grudge. A blood relative of the slain Cassander, for instance, or the friends and families of the thousands of Gascon soldiers killed in the war. Dante's role had generated far too much anguish to assume he could move through these lands in safety. On the morning of the day they expected to reach Setevan, they entered a quiet forest. Sparrows flitted across the road, passing through thin beams of light. They had traveled 300 miles, and with their destination so close, Dante let the horses amble at their own pace.
"Red shirts,"
C murmured. Dante snapped up his head. Down the leaf-littered road, men in red doublets blocked the way. King's men, just like the thousands Dante had plunged to their deaths in the final battle of the Chainbreaker's War. This time, there were just 8. He could kill them in moments if it came to it, yet his pulse quickened. The last thing Dante needed was to draw attention, and, by definition, there was no such thing as a safe fight. Hurriedly, he called on the Nether and went to work on his face, shifting the planes of his cheekbones, lengthening his nose, thickening his brows. The illusions were slight, a dim version of the method Kali had used when he'd infiltrated the council, but it should be enough to hide his identity. "Act normal," he said. "No killing." C gave him a look. "Do your friends normally have to be ordered not to kill strangers?"
"He's reminding himself," Lou muttered.
Dante shook his head. He let C lead. She slowed as they approached the soldiers. The men watched them alertly, but didn't reach for swords or bows. Once C rode within 20 feet, a trooper held up his hand. C stopped and nodded in greeting.
"Where are you headed?"
the soldier said.
"Setevan," C said.
Early in the trip, they'd arranged a cover story.
"We're on business from Tatonin."
"Are you armed?" C flipped back her cloak to show the scabbard on her hip.
"If I draw this, it'll flash."
"Why do you have weapons?"
"For the same reason you do, I expect."
The redshirt nodded.
"Have you run into trouble? Seen anything fishy?"
"Nothing but quiet. Something we should be wary of."
"Highwayman," the man spat. "We appear to have cleared out the vermin, but be on watch."
C tipped her head.
"Will do. Safe travels."
The group parted, allowing them to ride through. Lou looked back. Dante didn't. C waited until they were out of earshot.
"Awfully close to the capital for bandits."
"Is this road normally patrolled?" Dante said.
"Rarely."
She flashed a grin.
"Or I would have been caught years ago."
Dante kept his eyes open, and they crossed the forest without incident, riding into a wide plain of farms and hamlets. At one settlement, another group of redshirts eyed them, but let them pass without questions. Then Setevan sprawled before them, stretched across the hills and the river, bustling with trade and life, smoky from chimneys, raucous with talk and clicking hooves and shutters squeaking closed against the growing cold of late afternoon. Dante could smell the manure from beyond the walls, but as they rode through the white gate on the south end of town, the odor was fought by wood smoke, the freshwater smell of the river, and frying bacon, which Setevan was famous for. It looked younger than Narashtovik, perhaps because it wasn't littered with ruins, yet it had the unmistakable appearance of a city that's been around for eras. Many of the structures were patchwork, wooden upper floors atop stone ground floors, row houses grafted onto each other one after another, classical arches on a temple of Menok beside a manor house designed with modern parallel lines. As in Narashtovik, many of the locals wore long coats, but the people here combined them with round hats trimmed with fur. Lou glanced from side to side.
"Doesn't look like the capital felt the war at all."
"They felt it," Dante said. "You'll note they haven't come back."
"Time to get off the street," C said. "Establish a base of operations."
Dante had never been to Setevan before, so he left the logistics in her hands. She took them to an inn in the Baker's district. Staff led the horses to their stables. The shutters in Dante's second-floor room were open, and the whole room smelled of rising bread. Despite the agreeable aroma, he closed up the window. "What now?"
"Depends," C said. "What are you going to do when you find him?"
"That's for me to decide."
"I don't care if you mean to spit him like a hog or serve him in honey, but what you want done impacts how I go about finding him."
Dante shook his head. "I won't know that until I know what he's doing here. Just get me intel. Quietly."
C snorted. "Will do, boss. Guess you better stay out of sight until I'm back."
She took her sword and a small pack with her. Dante sent Lou downstairs for food and stoked up the fire. Lou returned with bread, stew, and sour green apples that were Dante's favorite. He eyed Lou. Did the kid spy on his meals, too? He couldn't complain about the fare, though. The stew was potatoes and bacon, and so heavily peppered it burnt his tongue. The sort of thing an innkeeper might do to hide the taste of spoiled meat, but the stew tasted so good, Dante figured the Setevites just had a thing for spice.
"What if it turns out C's right?" Lou said, around a mouthful of bread. "If he's doing business with Setevan, doesn't that make him a traitor?"
"No," Dante said after a moment. We're not at war any more. There's no use speculating until we hear what C has to say. Mercifully, that put an end to the conversation. After dinner, Lou nodded off in his chair. With nothing better to do, Dante did the same. It was dark and quiet when C returned.
Have a nice nap, she said. Ready to meet my informant, or would you rather catch another 40 winks first?
Dante stood. Let's go. Lou blinked from his chair, annoyed, but he followed them downstairs. Setevan was the Gascon capital, but it was hardly better lit than any other major city. C found a wide street where lanterns burned at major intersections and over the stoops of public houses and tea shops. She hooked right down a side street. Over the course of 3 blocks, the neighborhood shifted from pleasant and prosperous to mean and grim. Pools of stagnant water forced them to swerve like drunks. The lanterns were gone, feebly replaced by the quarter moon and a few open windows. People cackled and argued. Dante pulled the nether to his hands. C swung into an alley littered with garbage and sleeping vagabonds. Wash lines crisscrossed the air between the crooked row houses. She turned into a dead end, abutting the backs of several connected buildings. There, a bearded man sat on a blanket, clicking around a set of clay tiles inscribed with what looked to be old Gascon runes.
Took you long enough, he said.
C jerked her thumb at Dante.
Tell him what you told me.
Still fiddling with his tiles, the man gazed at Dante.
Couple months back, one of Lord Pendulous's servants had me arrested for loitering. Lives on Dunvern Street. Big pink house.
Did you see him? Dante said.
The man himself?
The bearded man laughed.
Course not. They had me arrested so people like him wouldn't have to see me.
Do you know if he still lives here?
Yeah, let me check with my vizier.
Pay him, C said. 5 hammers.
Dante spent enough time on the streets to recognize the slang for iron coins. He counted them out and handed them to the man, who rattled them around his palm and nodded. C thanked him and walked away.
That's it, Dante said. Why didn't you just tell me yourself?
Because he would have demanded I take you straight to him and ask your own questions.
She brushed back her hair.
Anyway, I wasn't about to spend my money.
On the way back to the inn, they hashed out their next step. They knew where Pendulous lived. Now it was time to determine whether Pendulous was, in fact, Blaze. While Lou might be able to positively identify him, Dante wanted to do so himself. That meant staking out Dunvern Street. Dante could disguise himself, be it magically or mundanely, but if he were to hang out in the open, Blaze was canny enough to recognize him by posture or gesture. He couldn't use a dead bug to infiltrate the house either. They never moved right. To most people, it would just look like his moth spy was sick. But Blaze would know it for what it was. Dante needed somewhere he could watch from in secret. That meant attempting to rent a room. C could handle that, but they were dressed for travel, not doing business in one of Setevan's trendiest neighborhoods. If they were to walk into Dunvern Street in dirty cloaks and scuffed boots, they might be kicked out on sight. Even if they were allowed to roam around, no landlord or innkeeper would let C degrade his property with her presence. In short, they needed new clothes. Acquiring these ate up the next morning. As soon as they finished, C hired a carriage. She couldn't arrive on foot for the same reason she couldn't wander around in dingy clothes, and besides, the hackney might know who in the neighborhood was renting, and headed off for richer pastures. That left Dante and Lou in their room. Dante had brought a kappa scale with him, and killed time trying to study it. But since he couldn't reach inside it with the nether, there was little for him to see. Lou had got his hands on parchment and a quill. He spent all day parked in the windows, scribbling away. A report to Ollivander. If so, it certainly was detailed. Anyway, Lou would probably be less open about it. Poetry, then. Or a letter to his mom. At sunset, catcalls erupted from the common room downstairs. Dante wasn't surprised in the slightest when C opened their door a minute later. She had chosen a sleek purple dress that wasn't shy about expressing her décolletage. She gave Dante a look that could have cut boiled leather. "One word and you can book your room yourself." He splayed his palms. "I think you look regal. If nothing else, I'm the queen of getting things done. Your room is right across the street." "Can we go now?" "Sure, but unless you want to crack your skull, you should stay seated until you hear the bill." She quoted him the room's rate, but the silver meant nothing to him. They packed their things, and Dante and Lou donned their new dress, formal long jackets, shiny boots, and fur-trimmed hats. They flagged a carriage and headed across town. As the name suggested, Dunvern Street straddled a high hill interrupted by parks, paths, and assorted greenery. Below its crest, the road leveled, overlooking a slope too steep for structures. The city sprawled to all sides, darkness pricked by 10,000 lanterns and candles. Miles away, moonlight bounced from a lake and shined on the confectionery eminence of the palace. The road curved from the cliffs into rows of stately residences with little space between them. The carriage creaked to a stop in front of a pillared white structure labeled the Hotel Austere. Dante paid the driver and exited. He wore a hat and had selected a coat with a collar that rose to his nose, yet in the cold, quiet street he felt exposed to the world. He dreaded every second C and Lou dawdled inside the carriage. At the hotel entrance, a doorman examined them, then saw C and smiled. His eyes moved to Dante and Lou, and his expression flickered with amusement. As he led the three of them up a grand staircase to a rug-padded hallway, Dante understood. The doorman believed Dante and C were wealthy blue bloods who'd paid Lou for a night of fun. As that made it less likely they'd be interrupted, Dante was content to maintain that illusion. He followed the man to the reserved room, tipped him, and winked. The doorman closed the door and padded away down the hall. Dante went to the window and parted the curtains. Bubbled glass filled the panes, presenting a sweeping view of the dim street. "Which one?" C moved beside him and pointed to a house almost directly across from them. "That's it. Looks like a blaze house to you?" "A blaze house would be walled with rum bottles and roofed with swords cleaned to an obsessive degree. Side note, if he invites you over, I wouldn't visit on a windy day." "If he learns I'm the one who brought you to him, I doubt he'll be inviting me anywhere." He dragged a chair to the window. "Douse the lights. You'll have to entertain yourselves in the dark."
"I'll keep the heavy breathing to a minimum," C said.
He scowled. They took a couple minutes to settle in, then blew out the candles, casting the room into darkness. Dante sat and waited. The cold of the night seeped through the window, chilling his hands and face. Dunvern Street was one of the capital's nexuses, a hotbed of trade, fashion, and society. Though it was well after dark, the road thrummed with pedestrians, riders, and carriages. Red-uniformed watchmen patrolled the way, protecting the taxpayers, many of whom were escorted by personal bodyguards as well. It was a veritable crowd, but no one approached the Pink Manor. As the night deepened, the street calmed. Only the watchman remained. The watchman and Dante. Dawn poked through the gap in the curtains. Blankets stirred behind him.
"Have you been there all night?" Lou croaked.
Dante didn't turn. "What do you think?"
"That you're cranky when you haven't got any sleep. Want a break?"
"Will you know him if you see him?"
"I'll wake you if anyone comes or goes from the house."
Dante sighed and stood, staggering on his stiff legs.
"A nap might do me some good."
Lou sat in a nest of blankets on the floor. C had claimed the poster bed and was stirring, woken by their voices.
"You look like a dried-up frog," she laughed. "I'm guessing you haven't seen him."
"With such uncanny powers of deduction, it's no wonder you're so good at your job."
Dante shrugged off his coat and draped it over a chair.
Lou replaced him at the window. Dante stretched his legs, wandering closer to see.
"Speaking of, I need you to hit the streets again. I have to know more about what Blaze is doing here."
C rubbed her eyes and stretched an arm above her head. Elbow talked.
"I've got a contact on the other side of the hill. I'll see what she's heard. Right after I've had some damn tea."
That sounded pretty good, but sleep sounded even better. Dante installed himself in the bed, which smells like hotel perfume and C's skin, and quickly drifted into the realm between consciousness and proper sleep. He stayed there some time, vaguely aware of the noise of C preparing to depart. As soon as the door clicked, he fell into a dead slumber.
A hand shook his shoulder. He smacked at it and slapped his face. He jolted upright, feeling dizzy and sick from too little sleep, head pounding.
Lou pointed at the window. Dante's heart drummed his ribs. He ran to the window. Outside the pink house, a sleek carriage sat in the noon sun. A man hunched inside it with one hand on the running board, fishing around its floorboards, back turned to the hotel. The man straightened, put whatever he'd found into the pocket of his sweeping coat, turned, and looked Dante straight in the eye. Or so it felt. In truth, Dante watched through the narrowest sliver of window, obscured by a heavy curtain and the glare of the sun on the glass. In the street, the man planted his palms on the small of his back and leaned back until it looked like he'd snap in half. Dante had seen that stretch a thousand times before. He moved to the side of the window.
"Well?" Lou said.
Dante nodded blankly.
Lou gestured frantically. "And?"
"We wait for C." He sent Lou down for tea. He hadn't known how he'd feel at this moment, but he hadn't expected this numbness. He had no idea what to do next. Ironically, if he and Blaze had still been companions, Blaze would have come up with the perfect solution in a trice. They had complimented each other, improvising their way through a thousand different disasters. 3 years later, Dante still wasn't used to making decisions without having his thoughts challenged and improved at every step of the process. Lou returned with tea. Dante thanked him. More words almost followed, but something stopped him. C got back a few hours later.
"We're in luck. Dunvan Street is as incestuous as the royal family."
Lou wrinkled his nose.
"What's so lucky about that?"
"My person knows a person. Their person's already agreed to speak to us tonight." Dante refilled his mug.
"Tell me it's not another trip to that above-ground sewer we visited the other night."
"It's a temple," C said.
"Will that work? Or will you burst into flames if you step inside?"
"The temple might," he said. "But that's its problem." With the meeting hours away, Dante caught another nap. C got out a deck of cards, cajoled Lou into playing, and methodically fleeced him of every penny in his pockets. The hour arrived. Once more they donned their fancy garb and hit the streets. It was close to midnight, and except for a few intoxicated revelers,
The only other travellers on Dunvern Street were the city guard. Dante made a show of chatting about the party they were on their way to crash, chuckling heartily. C strode ahead, turning down a leaf-strewn alley that opened into a pedestrian mall. She crossed this without a second glance, taking them to a stone staircase set in the side of a hill. After a brief stretch of wooded parkland, the ground leveled and cleared. The temple topping the hill was from an earlier age, but even at a distance, its hexagonal spire gave it away. It was dedicated to Tame, father of time and judgment. Dante couldn't help wondering if there was a symbolic element to their context's choice of location. The base was hexagonal, too, capped by a slate dome. Out front, a pedestal displayed a small blue flame, burning unattended. C took them around the back, where a viciously narrow staircase had been wrought into a seam in the temple. Their boots scuffed on the steps. The temple dome was painted with silver points, a map of the night sky. 80 feet up, the top of the dome flattened to a platform, allowing a view of the city and access to the spire. A shadow moved from the spire and stood across from them.
"Why do you want to know about Pendulous?"
Dante had no idea which lie was best.
"I believe he might not be entirely trustworthy."
"Do you represent the king?" the woman asked.
"Far from it. Do you?"
She laughed sourly.
"I represent one of the many people the king has wronged."
"That being..."
"A lady who deserves better than to be run over roughshod."
She slitted her eyes.
"That's all you need to know."
"Fair enough," Dante said.
A breeze picked up, and though his footing was perfectly sound, he couldn't stop himself from throwing out his hands for balance.
"So, what is Pendulous doing in Setevan?"
"Are you aware of Bossen?"
"The clothes? Like the Norrin make?
And are you aware it is the most prized object in the land?"
"Pendulous practically has a monopoly on it, and he's about to turn that monopoly over to the king."
"What?"
Dante blurted.
"Why?"
The servant made a face.
"Why do you think? To get filthy, stinking rich. My lady had a deal in place, but when Mordigan caught wind of it, he decided to snatch it up for himself. Pendulous couldn't say no to the king. He was probably happy for a chance to acquire a tie to the throne."
"I'm sorry to hear that," Dante managed, head spinning. "Then anything more you can tell me will serve both our aims."
"The deal goes down in 2 days."
The woman grinned ruefully at the spire.
"That's why I came here. Figured I'd beseech Tame to knock the palace to the ground."
"You never know. Thank you for your time."
Dante bowed and headed back down the steps. Back on the ground, he turned to see.
"Good work."
"I know," she said. "Now can we get back to Narashtavik and fit me for my new uniform? I look deadly in black and silver."
"Just one more step." He gazed into the night. "Blaze is no longer the man I once knew. It's time to expose his true colors to the king."
Chapter 8 Taya absorbed his story about the meeting as thoughtfully as ever. When he finished, she said,
"Have you thought about why Mordigan is offering to buy you out?"
Blaze shrugged.
"So he can fill his basement with coins and swim around in them like an avaricious duck?" "In your pursuit of the Duke, you've been blathering far and wide about the deal for weeks. The king's known about it at least that long, possibly since the first day you mentioned Bossen. Why swoop in now?"
He went still, following the lines of her logic.
"To hide something. To protect the Duke. His nephew."
Taya nodded once.
"The Duke couldn't afford the Bossen, so he thought to steal it instead. Somehow, Mordigan was led to believe you knew who was behind the attack on our wagons,
and now he's buying your silence.
You're devious, aren't you? Should I be hiding the kitchen knives when I sleep?
Blaze folded his arms and watched Dunvern Street through the window.
Follow-up question. So what?
That the king is duping you?
He's buying my bosom, isn't he? He'll have more than anyone in Setevan.
He won't flip it the next day. He'll try to dribble it out to maximize his investment. Meanwhile, we flood the market beneath him.
This is significantly more dangerous than going after the Duke.
Dillinger is a cad, a fool. If he were to go bankrupt, the court would echo with, "I told you so." Whereas the king is far too savvy to sink his wealth into a bum horse.
Taya lifted her finger and pointed at him,
meaning he'll pin the blame on the horse trader.
He's fettered by the inconvenient fact his nephew tried to rob me. If he tries to come after us, he risks exposing Dillinger and his own attempt to cover up the crime.
And if he loses his fortune, revenge might throw reason out the window.
She circled her finger on the arm of her chair.
I'll work on finding direct evidence between Duke Dillinger and the bandits. If Modigan winds up coming for us, it would be nice to have a dagger and not an empty sheath.
Agreed. Time to order more bosom into Dollenden, too. Oh, you know what else you should do? Start thinking of how you'll spend our upcoming hoard of riches. I was thinking of buying a fleet, personally. Seems useful.
They both knew the funds generated from this venture would go right back into bringing Gask to its oppressive knees. But it was amusing to pretend. Anyway, they'd been building for this for so long that no one could blame him for feeling buzzed. And through dumb luck, or, more accurately, due to a ruthless, single-minded, months-long campaign, they'd come further than he'd ever imagined. The Bossen Gambit wouldn't be enough to wreck Modigan by itself, but the kingdom had been sorely lacking in free labor, since the Norren had wrested themselves from their chains, and with fewer taxes out of Galador, and none at all from the newly independent Narashtivik, the once mighty Gascon Empire was looking a little shabby around the edges. A bit wobbly. A good shove would only knock it further off balance, and if some other disturbance came along after that... Enough dreaming. He had just 3 days until he'd return to the palace and seal the deal. He still had to bring the bossen in from the country. Now that he'd struck a bargain with the king himself, he didn't think there would be any more attempts to steal it, but you never knew. Once the goods were on the move into the city, he didn't intend to let them out of his sight until he shook hands with Modigan and replaced the crates of clothes with chests of silver. He spent the rest of the day down at the warehouse, preparing it to shelter the wagons. The next day, while Taya pursued gossip and intrigue, he rode to the country and drove the bossen back to Setevan. They parked the wagons in the warehouse. He and the guards set up beds there, maintaining a constant vigil over their prize. The sun rose on the day of the deal. He dressed in his finery, even the ridiculous little tri-corner hat currently in vogue. A squadron of red-shirted cavalry arrived at the warehouse while he prepared, augmenting his guards. There were perks of doing business with the crown. Bathed and outfitted, Blaze strolled into the daylight and saluted the commander of the cavalry.
"Shall we?"
The man nodded. Blaze climbed into his carriage. The procession rattled over the cobblestones, barged its way across town, and crossed the causeway to the palace. The wagons ground to a stop in the gravel. There existed the chance, however remote, that Modigan was on to them, and that this was an elaborate counter-sting. In case things went bad, he'd arranged for Taya to bug out with the wagons and hide at a safe house in the country. Paranoid, but when you are dealing with this much money, there was no such thing as being too cautious. There, outside the palace, Blaze nodded to her, and she nodded back. He was met by the same servant who'd summoned him to the king 3 days ago. As the two of them walked inside, guards and teamsters moved the wagons around the side of the palace to conduct the physical exchange of bossen and hard currency, which would be inspected by Modigan and Pendulous's staff. The two of them were too lofty to degrade themselves by being concerned with money.
His Highness awaits, the servant said.
Boy, even when he's sitting around he makes it sound impressive. Blaze glanced through the marble foyer. He had a sword on his hip, ostensibly decorative, and a knife on his calf, but he saw no signs he'd be needing to put them to use.
They climbed onto the lift and were borne up to the top layer of the edifice. The guards eyed Blaze and allowed him past. Rather than being deposited in the cramp, windowless room where he'd first met Modigan, he was escorted to a lavish, sprawling chamber of tables, chairs, chaises, and benches, with a stage at one end and a panoramic view of the lake and the city beyond. Servants bustled about, offering refreshments on silver trays to the handful of nobles present. Statuesque guardsmen flanked the windows, staring levelly. There was no sign of Modigan, but Blaze's attention was diverted by servants offering him crystal goblets of dark wine and assorted dishes of things stuffed and or wrapped with other things. As he ate and drank, the people of importance drifted up to him in ones and twos to exchange standard party chatter. The weather, upcoming holidays, the ways Pendulous's homeland differed from Setevan, and which he preferred better. Yet they were also unusually forward about business matters. What else did he deal in? Did he believe demand for Norrin goods would continue to increase? Yes? To which Nulla, then? This event was a celebration of the Bossen deal, but it soon became clear that it was about something more, introducing Pendulous to the king's friends and business partners, so they, too, could fatten themselves on the new markets Pendulous was bringing to the table. This had large and wonderful implications for he and Taya's campaign against the Empire. He was too busy exchanging bon mots and advice with the upper crust to properly explore the avenues opening before him, but now that he knew they were there, he looked forward to turning them into his new stomping grounds. A hush fell over the room. Heads turned. The king had entered. Modigan had ruled for decades and was practical to the point of severity. The sort who placed function several rungs above form. He wore a red doublet of elegant simplicity and a crown with as few frills as a wedding band.
"Good morning," he said, stopping at the edge of the stage. "I hope you are enjoying yourselves. Please continue to do so."
Some of the younger nobles in attendance glanced around, awaiting some regal speech, but Modigan descended the steps and crossed to Blaze.
"Lord Pendulous."
Blaze bowed his head. "Your Highness, my people have assessed the goods. Should I inform them the transaction is complete?"
"That depends. Do you think the palace is sturdy enough to bear all the shiny new coins that are about to flow into it?"
Modigan snorted, crooking the corner of his mouth.
"You are well practiced in mockery, to turn it on a king, especially when you compel him to enjoy it."
He made a small, rolling gesture. A pole-bearing servant stepped out onto the broad stone balcony and waved a white flag back and forth. Far below, horses snorted and jangled.
A thin servant stepped beside them.
"Your Highness."
Modigan didn't turn.
"I am in the middle of something."
"I had noticed the celebration, and would not dare to interrupt it."
The man smiled with a happy arrogance,
"except that the matter I bring before you is directly relevant to it."
"Cease interrupting me, or you will be escorted to a place where you will have no company to interrupt."
The servant adopted a look of shock.
"You would imprison me for warning you of an attempt at treason?"
Finally, the king turned to meet the man's eyes.
"That would be a charge which, if presented falsely, would be grounds for the death not of the accused, but the accuser."
"You wish proof?" the man said thoughtfully. "What kind?"
"Like the swords I'll turn on you if you keep stalling. Hard and swift."
The servant nodded, winked at Blaze, and snapped his fingers. The man vanished, replaced by Dante fucking Galland.
"Greetings, Your Majesty," he said, no longer disguising his voice. "We've never met, so I won't blame you if you don't recognize me." The king blinked and actually fell back half a step, faltering on his bad leg, yet he managed to keep his voice level. "You are known to me." "There is no need for worry," Dante said. "It's not you I'm here to see. Rather, it's the man disguised in your midst." The king swiveled his head toward Blaze. Blaze tipped his head and sighed at the ceiling.
"You idiot."
Modigan's jaw bulged. "What is your real name?" "Pendulous." Blaze thrust back his shoulders. The jig was up. There was nothing left but to try to cause a riot and let his wits take it from there. Pendulous testicles. A blanket of silence muffled the room. As suddenly as that blanket being ripped from the bed of a man who's overslept, the chamber erupted with shouts, questions, and the whisper of swords yanked from sheaths. "Take them alive if you can," Modigan commanded, retreating. "But I won't blame you if you have no choice." "Great job," Blaze shouted at Dante. "You ruined everything, and we'll spend the rest of our lives in a dungeon." Dante grabbed his elbow. "Wrong." The king's men advanced, sword tips glaring. Dante laughed. The stone floor beneath Blaze's feet pulled away like oil sliding across a hot pan. Blaze yelped and fell into the void. A plucky guard leapt after them in hot pursuit, but the stone swept back to its former shape, sticking the man fast at the waist. His legs kicked in confusion. Blaze slammed into the ground, and into something else, too, judging by the jolt of his elbow. A plush rug had cushioned his fall. He pushed himself to his knees and examined his elbow. Blood pattered to the carpet. "Do you have any idea what you just destroyed?" he said. "Besides this table?" Dante grimaced and sat up amid its splinters. "You mean your attempt to refill the king's war coffers?" "I was going to empty them, to smash this whole kingdom!" Blaze tried to rise, but his elbow quivered and gave out. Dante swabbed this cut with a handkerchief, then swathed it in nether, sealing the wound as quickly as it had appeared. "Bullshit! You've been enriching these people for over a year!" He got to his feet, pulling Blaze up with him. A bald old man gaped at them like a breathless eagle. Boots stomped upstairs. Shouts rang through the cavernous halls. Dante grabbed Blaze's elbow and dashed toward the terrace. "What are you doing here?" Blaze said. "I came to explain. To apologize." Dante flung open the door to the brittle daylight. "And to snap you out of whatever madness sent you down this path." Blaze wanted nothing more than to explain in detail how Dante had just saved Narashtivik's worst enemy. That bit of knowledge would fester in Dante's gut for sure, but there wasn't time. Dante had a route out of the top layers of the palace, and if Blaze didn't follow, he'd be caught and tortured. He dashed out onto the stone sweep of the terrace. "I don't need your apology. All I need is for you to leave me alone." "It doesn't have to be this way. I had no other choice." "Than to kill the only woman I've ever loved?" For an instant, that silenced him. Dante reached the waist-high railing at the edge of the balcony. Others extended beneath them in narrow terraces, each ledge separated by a 20-foot fall. Dante gritted his teeth. "If I hadn't, we all would have died. What else could I do?" Blaze glanced behind them. "No pursuit yet." "You can wave your hands and put a hole through a marble floor. How hard would it have been to get her out of harm's way?" Dante got a vague look on his face. Blaze felt it in the air, the way he always did when Dante summoned the shadows prior to accomplishing something ridiculous. A yard-wide ribbon of stone shot from the edge of the balcony and slanted down to the one below it. But it didn't stop there. The same thing was happening on every level. The strip was bent up at its edges, like a slide. Dante fell on his ass. His face had gone as pale as a cavefish. "Maybe there was," he gasped. "Maybe there was another way, and I was too foolish to see it. But I can't undo it. No one can bring back the dead."
You're right, Lee said. It's done. And so am I.
The color seeped back into Dante's cheeks. He stood shakily and stepped over the railing onto the top of the slide.
You're sure?
I'm sure.
And what are you going to do about it?
A look stole over Dante's eyes. One Blaze knew too well. Dante gestured for him to cross the rail.
Bring you to your senses.
Once again, you've opened my eyes to what I must do.
Blaze stepped over, peered down the slide, and shoved Dante over the edge.
Before Dante had time to cry out, Blaze jumped onto the slide. Air whisked past his face. The slide was as smooth as the stones at the bottom of a mountain stream, and he accelerated quickly. Something thumped behind him, but he didn't bother to turn. He had no illusions Dante was dead. The damned warlock had probably turned the stone below him into a friendly mud puddle. Even if he hadn't had time for sorcery and had snapped a few bones, he could knit them back together with a snap of his fingers. Blaze's only hope was to outrun him.
The slide was providing him an admirable head start. His eyes watered. He lay back, gliding on his shoulder blades and the worn leather heels of his boots. The tip of his scabbard skittered. He clamped the weapon to his thigh. After shooting down three levels, he sat up to slow down and get a look around. Below, his caravan was already on its way across the causeway. Guards were shouting from up top, but the lift would take a couple minutes to get downstairs. The grounds immediately in front of the palace were clear. And he was approaching them at an amazing speed. He splayed his feet, attempting to drag his soles without yanking his legs off. It helped, as did spreading his arms to the wind, but he was still descending at lethal speed. He pulled his sword from his belt. As he hit the gentling curve of the slide's end, he leaned into a crouch, flung the blade as far ahead as he could, and leapt. Turf soared beneath him. He tucked his chin to his chest and angled his wrist over his head, letting his arm fold as he struck the ground. He rolled onto his shoulder, somersaulting three times before skidding to a stop. His whole body smelled like damp grass. It hurt pretty badly, too. But he got up, ran back for his sword, and charged onto the gravel road, where a groomsman readied a horse.
"Ah, right where I left it," Blaze said.
He brandished his blade in customary threatening manner. The groomsman ran off with a moan. Blaze jumped onto the horse's side, wrestled himself into the saddle, and drove it toward the causeway.
Men cried out behind him.
Too bad for them. They should have taken the slide.
He thundered forward, gaining rapidly on the dawdling caravan, which had no reason to believe anything was wrong. The rearmost riders turned. He put away his sword and waved his hands over his head, then gestured forward, urging them on. They exchanged a look, then called to the drivers. The wagons picked up speed.
He reached them at the same moment guards spilled from the palace door. Taya detached from the caravan and rode back to meet him.
"It's over. Dante found me. He exposed me to the king."
Taya eyed him levelly.
"You're sure? Given how absurd the events of the last 3 minutes have been, this could be a wild fever dream, but if we are in fact real, I'd advise you to get out of town as fast as possible. Continue our work however you can."
"And you?"
"He's got my blood," Blaze said. "Sneaky bastard pretended he was healing me. With that he can track me anywhere."
"So where will you go?"
"The one place he can't follow."
"That tells me nothing," she said, "which I suppose is for the best. We'll regroup and continue as best we can."
"Sorry to leave you in the lurch," Blaze said. "It's been wonderful to work with you, Taya."
"I'll see you again someday, promise."
As unruffled as ever, she nodded, then turned to their men and began barking orders. Blaze sighed and charged forward. At the gates between the bridge and the Street of Kings, he waved gaily to the red-shirted guards who nodded back. Blaze wasn't surprised they hadn't caught on. They were used to keeping people out, not keeping them in.
He cut south through the city. It was what they'd expect.
If they believed he was in league with Narashtovic, the obvious first leg would be the southern road to Dolandun. But they had no way to catch up with him, not if he kept riding. He juked around pedestrians, hat long gone to the winds, just starting to feel the aches in his shoulders and ribs.